Welcome to Sacred Legions. I'm Max Goller, and Sacred Legions is dedicated to the idea of secular sainthood. Kurt's definition of a saint was a person who behaves decently in a shockingly indecent society. And today I have the great privilege of welcoming Ben Price, who is the Education Director for Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDEF. So we're going to have a discussion about the rights of people and challenging rights for the environment, too. So thank you for being with us today, Ben.
Well, thanks a whole lot. I really appreciate you having me here, Max.
So can you tell me something about CELDEF's beginning? Because it sounded like you were there from the beginning. Tell me about what that organization is dedicated to doing.
Sure. Actually, I wasn't there at the very beginning, which was around 1995, when the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund began as kind of a traditional environmental advocacy group. And that meant working with communities that, say, were opposed to land application of sewage sludge. They use it for fertilizer and it's toxic and it's legal. Has been for years. Also, factory farms that people saw as destroying local farming communities, helping communities to stop toxic landfills. And these days, a big issue is the erection of data centers that wipe out local aquifers, use up enormous amounts of water, use up enormous amounts of fossil fuels, which we're trying to cut back on because of the climate crisis. Starting, say, around 2005, throughout the areas of Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia, Virginia, and out in the West, Texas and Oklahoma and so forth, fracking was a huge issue. And communities wanted to say, no, we don't want you to come in, drill down through our drinking water aquifers where, you know, people use wells to get groundwater for drinking in rural communities. And they didn't think it was a great idea to have pipes drilled down through their aquifers to access fossil fuel gas trapped in rocks deep down in the ground a mile or two, and then bringing that gas right up through a pipe through the aquifers, assuming that there'll certainly never be any migration of those toxic, and it's not just the gases, but radon and other radioactive materials that are buried, you know, naturally, deeply away where they don't do any harm to anyone until industry brings it back to the surface and then doesn't know what to do with it once they have it, that kind of waste stuff. So we helped communities. When I say that's what we worked on to begin with, but our methods were traditional and also unsuccessful in the beginning, which is to say we worked within the legal system, and the legal system that is presented to communities across the country, every municipality, every county, we are trapped in a regulatory system, and actually belief in a regulatory fallacy, the idea that we can regulate the amount of harm that's done to communities and to their natural environments. And in regulating that, we can reduce the harms. I'm going to just go through this real quickly to say, when you regulate a thing like harm to the environment, we're putting poisons in people's drinking water or the soil where they grow their food. When you regulate that, what you're actually doing is allowing it to happen, but only up to a certain amount. That's what regulation means. It doesn't mean protecting the environment. It doesn't mean protecting the drinking water. It means limiting how much you toxify those things. And when you regulate the rate of destruction of an environment, or of a water supply, when you regulate the rate of destruction, you're not protecting anything. What you're doing is timing how long it will take until you have completely destroyed it. You're not actually protecting it. You're saying, we're going to not destroy it immediately. We're going to let it take time to do it. And over that time, people will be consuming more and more toxins, and so will the animal and the plant life in the area, which seems to suggest that the industrial activities that are regulated, that it's actually understood that they will eventually do irreparable harm and damage to the health and safety of the people, the children, future generations and to the survivability of the ecosystems. So I'll just say this. We made a mistake in the first several years of our operation by going along with regulating the rate of destruction. And by around 2002 or so, we began to turn around and say, maybe that's not how we should do it. I joined the organization in 2003, full-time in 2004. And what we began to do then, as I was the first community organizer for CellDef, we began to go into the communities and asking them, instead of, what do you think we can get using the rules that we have? We started asking, what do you think you need? What do you think you want, regardless of the rules? Because the rules not only say, here are the regulations, they also put preemptions on top of the regulations so that local governments, municipalities, and counties are forbidden to protect the environment or their health and safety of the people any more strictly than the states regulate. It's called ceiling preemption. It puts a ceiling on how much protection that local law is allowed to afford to the community. And what's the limit on that protection is the state regulations, whatever the regulations are. For instance, if I live in Pennsylvania, so if the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania passes a law that says it's perfectly illegal, or I'm sorry, perfectly legal to frack, to put a pipe down in the ground, send chemicals down into the rock a mile or two in, and explode the rock in order to release the gas and then bring it back to the surface. If that's 100% legal, and it is, and the way we know it is because the state issues permits that permit it to happen. It's right in the word, permit. It is an allowance. It is the permission of the state to engage in this activity. Now, if it's a legal action, then the community is put in a defensive position of having to argue that what's been legalized is harmful and shouldn't be allowed. That argument doesn't go very far when the regulations have been put into law that say, well, 10,000 parts, for instance, per million of this toxin in your drinking water, we're going to allow that to happen. But 12,000 parts per million is not allowed. That's too much. So, you know, 10,000 parts per million, what, every year from each corporation dumping that into the ground. And over the years, the accumulated harms are significant and growing, as we can see. Since environmental regulation began, say, back in the 1970s, with the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, all of those things that came into law during the Nixon administration. No tree hugger himself, of course. Those regulatory agencies and those regulations were put in place because it was understood they would not interfere with industry, because the regulations would always leave room for industry to do the harm they needed to do to make the profits that they desire. That is not the way that we organize anymore.
Now, you mentioned that when you first started out, you were taking a traditional path to try to fight some of these things that were going on, the toxins that are being released through fracking and the data centers that obviously are very big now. What changed? Where were you and how did you change? And has it been more successful?
You know, we changed because it became clear to us that what we were doing actually was not creating the outcomes that we were hoping for and that people were counting on us to help them create. So, for instance, a community says, well, we want to prevent a permit from being issued that would allow Corporation X to, say, apply toxic sewage sludge to fields locally and pretend that it's healthy for growing our food and so forth. And so we would go to the hearings, the regulatory hearings, with the local community organizations. We would argue that the permit should not be issued for various reasons. The agencies are not interested in hearing reasons that the community is alarmed about the safety over an issue, because the claim is, well, that's above your pay grade, you local folks. We have scientists and people who are dedicated to figure out what's good for you and bad for you. We'll decide those things. What else have you got? How else can you try to stop this permit? So the only thing that's left for communities is to challenge whether the applicant, that is the corporation looking to do the operation, whether they've filled out the paperwork correctly, whether they've supplied all of the required information or studies or whatever it might be. And we had a very good track record of finding deficient applications for permits. The environmental impact study that they did is out of date and it can't be accepted. Now they have to go back and they have to do a new one. Well, what would happen? The corporation would spend the money, go back and do a new one, write off the cost as a cost of doing business, a tax deduction. They would now resubmit their application. They would get their permit and we would not have anything more that we could do within the legal realm to help protect the community, help it protect itself. This goes back to a time when, you know, Al Gore of Inconvenient Truth fame and vice presidency fame and stolen presidency fame, he, as vice president at the time, invited our staff to the White House to give us a little, you know, little award saying, look at you, you've got an 80% win record for challenging these permits for questionable activities, corporate activities. But having an 80% success rate in challenging permits doesn't actually tell the whole story because, as I mentioned, the corporations would go back, they would reapply after they had amended their applications, and they would get their permits, at which point we had no more way to help the communities to stop the toxic project. And it went forward. So the 80% success rate was really just a paper success. The right. Real success was in destroying local systems of environment, of economies, and the rest of it, because the system is set up to guarantee a win for the corporations and for profit makers. So what we did, rather than argue that the regulations simply weren't good enough, and they weren't, was to say that actually people in their communities have certain fundamental rights, things that this country was supposed to have been founded on. And here in 2026, 250-year anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, and in my mind, even more significantly, the publication of Thomas Paine's Common Sense that inspired the Declaration of Independence and the Revolution, that the ideals of those, what we'll call radical in a good way, radicals of the time, Sam Adams and Tom Paine and others, what they demanded was that people in their communities be the last word on what happens there. You know, the very first complaint in the Declaration of Independence against the king, used as a justification for mounting a revolution against the empire, the very first complaint mentioned of the 30-some complaints was that the empire, in the body of the king, he has refused us our local laws, the ones that we need for the better running of our communities. And I'm paraphrasing here, but essentially it said the king has vetoed our local laws when they don't fit in with the plans of the empire. Well, guess what? That's the very same thing going on right now in every community in the United States. Not one American citizen in the places where they live have self-governing rights. They're being denied and have been for more than, well, since 1789 when the U.S. Constitution was ratified. That's the true founding, by the way, of the United States of America, not 1776. That was right. The year we should commemorate as the violent overthrow of tyrannical government. And that is worth celebrating.
So with the change in approach, have you found more success in protecting communities? Because to me, that community level thing is incredibly important, because if you try to handle things at this macro level, it just doesn't seem to do anything. But if you've got just your local community, you can do an awful lot.
Yeah, it's tough when you say, what's your success rate? We always have people say, right. What's your success rate? Let's define success. The system as it stands right now will not allow success for the communities. So when there have been legal challenges to the laws that we have passed, laws that, for instance, say that the people of this community have an inalienable right to healthy water because water is the source of life. Without it, we die. And so if we have a right to life, we have a right to the elements that create life or allow it to proceed. And clean, healthy water is one of them. So we might have a place where there's concern about contaminating the aquifer or the groundwater through land application of toxic sewage sludge that includes everything that ever gets poured down a drain. It's not just human waste. It's everything from your auto repair shop to the hospital to you name it, to the factory, everything goes down the drain. The stuff that shouldn't go into the rivers is squeezed out, which sounds like a great idea. Clean water in the rivers, that's great. But what do they do with it? They take it out to rural communities and they give it away for free to farmers and tell them that it's healthy fertilizer. Well, free fertilizer is a lot cheaper than not free fertilizer. And so, yeah, it's accepted and used. The harm that's done includes putting PCBs and forever chemicals and all kinds of things in the soil that washes down into the streams and the drinking water. And that affects people, animals, plants, everything, all by way of not making corporations responsible for taking care of the waste from their manufacturing processes and the waste left over from their extracting processes. What happens is instead of taking on responsibility for that, they externalize the costs and the harm to the rest of us. That is sociopathic behavior, and we should be able to do something about it. So yeah, the laws that we helped communities enact recognize the rights of communities and of ecosystems too, rights of nature, to a healthy environment, to clean water and so forth. The courts have not seen it that way. The courts will not begin by examining whether our claims that people have certain rights is true or false. They start by saying, wait, have you exhausted all of the available legal remedies before coming to the court and arguing over rights, constitutional issues? Well, yeah, you can spend the rest of your life going through all of the administrative places you can go to argue. And in each case, and we've been through them, you will lose. Because the state, if it imposes preemption on local lawmaking that would interfere with corporate profit making, then whatever you do, even if it's to protect health and safety, you're wrong. It's illegal.
This ties back into, I was looking over the training that you have at CellDef, and I was fascinated by this idea of what a system is. So our systems of government, our systems of education, our systems of law. And I loved the meme that you had. I don't even know where it came from, but the posi-wid of the purpose of a system is what it does. So you can define it any way that you want, but in the end, you know what it is by what it does. Can you tell me more about that?
Well, we know that the so-called environmental protection regulatory system doesn't actually protect the environment. How do we know that? Because we look from at the point when those agencies and those laws were first put into place. And we can kind of put that around 1970 or so. And I say that with a caveat I'll come back to. But from the time of 1970 until 2026, if environmental protection laws actually protected the environment, we should be able to look at the environment and say, well, look, it's better than it was in 1970. or it's at least it's no worse. We know that that is exponentially untrue. And so the idea of posse-wid, the purpose of a system is what it does, it comes from systems thinking, and I can't quote the source at the moment, but I think it's there in our notes. But the idea being, let's forget about what the proponents of a system say it's meant to do, and that if it was only allowed to do what it's supposed to do, it would do what it's supposed to do. We know that we can look at any system, the American system of government. If it's supposed to create government by and for the people, then we should look around and say, well, look at that. Isn't it great that the government actually yields to the people what they demand and desire? We know that that's not true. It's been, decades now, but the Princeton study on democratic processes concluded that you can generally say that it never is the case that what the majority of Americans want, they get from their government. In general, what the 1%, the wealthiest people want, generally and regularly and routinely get what they want. And we could go into, you could have hours of conversation about why that is. And we could say corruption is a big part of it. And, given current news constantly in a drumbeat in our ears, that sure sounds right. But I want to say that it's not just the corruption of individuals. It's not just the moral lacking of humans in office and in positions of power. We have systemic corruption. Back to systems. The purpose of the system is what it does. And we can elect the nicest, most open-minded, and democracy-loving candidates in the world. But changing the nameplate on the door of the representative or the senator is not going to change the system and the rules that they have to work by. Once they're in office, I was almost going to say once they're in power, they're not in power. Once right. They're in office, the power is within the system itself. And the rules of the system, as I was describing, kind of the regulatory system, the purpose of the regulatory system is to allow corporate profits while creating the illusion that there is a democratic process for protecting the environment. And that's open to all citizens. What's actually open to all citizens is the right to vent and then not get what you want.
Yeah, which is why we have plenty of protests and for good reason. But, you're right. You look at that and what's happening because of that. And I know this being kind of influenced by the author Kurt Vonnegut, he had this idea of the two-party system that we look at is not the two-party system that actually exists. It's not Republican and Democrat, which we point to in America, but this idea that there are winners and losers and the winners always win and the losers always lose. And so that seems to be more what our system kind of dictates.
That's true. That's true. And if you want to talk about the two-party system, and we're talking about corporation, I've been mentioning them consistently here. Isn't it interesting that the U.S. Constitution mentions neither political parties nor corporations, and yet they are the two most powerful political forces in this country today? The corporations decide the policies. The parties agree on the corporate policies. The candidates take money from the corporations and get elected. By the way, the corporations and the lobbyists are involved in the process of really eliminating the folks, the candidates who might oppose their policies and elevating those that will support them. I mentioned the Princeton study. The results that the Princeton study reported on, that there's virtually no effect of the populace on the policy production in the United States government. The reason for that we can look at is the hostile takeover of the United States government, and it is now simply a mechanism, a tool for the realization of corporate policies on the public scale. And so there's an awful lot to unpack in all of this. And we have over the years offered Democracy School. It's been a weekend kind of a seminar where we deconstruct the system, starting with things like the regulatory system that people rely on as their way to protect their communities. But it's administrative law. It's what Sam Adams called ministerial government. It's what, and Sam Adams being a radical revolutionary who said, we have to reject the idea that the laws that England sends over to us and tells us, here are the laws that you can enforce in your communities, in the colonies, and no other. We have to look at that and say, we're not going to enforce your laws on our people because they're not our laws. You know, the idea of taxation without representation, that's great language, and we hear about it as a battle cry for the revolution. It actually was a saying that came out of the English Civil War 100 years earlier, where the commoners said, you have a House of Commons and the commoners are not allowed to occupy it or to be represented there. The commoners are just those not born of royal noble blood, but the majority of people have no say. In the colonies, the real argument wasn't about taxation without representation. It was more about what we can relate it to what happened here in 2008 when Barack Obama decided that it made sense to bail out the banks that were collapsing, that had made stupid ideas and loans and so forth. And how was that going to be paid for? By our grandchildren, by our children, by us, by future generations, because trillions of dollars can't be accounted for in a lifetime of paychecks for the whole population. I mean, it's just absurd. Well, that's exactly what happened back in the 1770s with the British East India Company, the largest corporation ever to exist on earth. At one point, it had a standing army in India larger than England's army. It was a corporation. It was chartered by Queen Elizabeth I in 1600. And by 1776, guess what? Sam Adams and his radicals in Boston decided to dump their tea into Boston Harbor. Why? Not just because it sounded like a lark, but because they understood that giant corporations had an effect and were putting pressure on the government that supposedly represented them, the king and the parliament, but in fact simply lorded over them and passed the taxes on to the colonists when the government in London lifted the taxes on the British East India Company to make them tax-free. And who had to pay for it? The colonists. Nothing different today. Who's going to pay the cost for the energy for the data centers? The taxpayers, the people who have to buy energy. And we understand that now that Venezuela is going to be run by Donald Trump, who can't apparently run his own corporations successfully, Venezuela is going to see its oil and gas infrastructure refurbished by the American taxpayers so that ExxonMobil and the rest of them can, you know, make billions and billions of dollars free of taxes and on the public dime for the infrastructure. These things have been going on since before the revolution. It was a central cause of the revolution that the 99% were suffering and paying for the whims of the 1% even back then. And here we are again, 250 years later. We could go through each of the grievances in the Declaration of Independence, point at them and say, that hasn't been solved. That hasn't been solved. This wasn't solved by the Constitution. Matter of fact, they were preserved. Those tyrannies, those oppressions have been saved and institutionalized in our current form.
So I want to talk about you mentioned the Democracy School, I guess is what I would describe it as, that CELDEF has going. Is this, can you tell me something about it? Is it like physical classes or is it all just information that's provided online? Or what is the idea of this democracy training?
The idea in general is to inform people about the honest truth of American history and government, and to talk about rights that have been abdicated by all of us because we don't think we can get them. And oftentimes it's really kind of a black hole of doubt we're trying to pull ourselves out of. We doubt that we have the competence to make these decisions, so we leave it up to the experts. We doubt we have the right to self-govern our own places where we live. Why? Because we've never done it. We've never been allowed. You know, we doubt our intelligence. We doubt our moral standing. We doubt our competence. Well, that's because we're dependent. We have been made dependent. We have been made incapable of making decisions because it's not something we're allowed to do. Democracy School began in 2003. We offered it in communities that would host the lectures for it, and you know, they would find a venue for it and so forth. But by the time COVID came around and there was all of the distancing, physical distancing from each other and so forth, we turned to online video presentations. We're looking again at the material, the curriculum for the school, and we're in the process of revamping that curriculum at this point. So we're looking to have a new version of the school. It would be great if we can get it done and have it available by the end of this year. We're hoping so. But education, and that's my current role as education director with CELDEF, it comes in a lot of packages. When we are called and asked to help a community to stand in the way of a large harmful corporate project extracting or competing or destroying local economies and so forth, then the education begins with the first conversation with a community group. We often say things like, well, you don't have a fracking problem. You have a democracy problem. If you weren't being denied your right to self-determination in the place where you live, if you weren't being denied the right to say no to harmful things coming to your community, then you would simply say no. It wouldn't be a fracking problem at all. Right now, the real problem is the denial of democratic rights to people across the country. And why are they being denied those rights? In order to uphold the privileges of wealth. That's the simple summation of it, that privilege and wealth are more important under American law than unalienable rights that were talked about in the Declaration of Independence. So if we're going to celebrate 1776, in my mind, that means we're going to have to be very critical of what came afterwards and what the Federalists did when they met in secret in Philadelphia, the town where I was born, and they put together a document that they recognized that all of the members, all of the delegates in the room were opposed to the idea of democracy. But with the revolution having just been concluded and commoners being armed to the teeth, it would be a bad time to do what they really wanted to do and what Alexander Hamilton of Broadway fame actually proposed, the New York Plan, which called for a limited monarchy, an executive for life. That's Donald Trump's, you know, he's a real Hamiltonian in that sense. Senators elected for life and a Supreme Court that could veto even their limited representative policies. A Supreme Court that actually has monarchical powers. They couldn't get away with putting together a limited monarchy, or there would have been another revolutionary surge among the people. And so what they did is they created the Supreme Court that could veto everything. What's interesting about that, though, one little tidbit is the Federalists did not state how many members there had to be on the Supreme Court. Congress decided that, and the number has changed over the years. But imagine this. What if Congress had said one, only one member of the Supreme Court? Wouldn't it be very clear then that we actually have a limited monarchical form of government, that that body, that court, has the authority to tell everyone, including the senators, including the members of the House of Representatives, sit down, be quiet. We're not listening to what the people want. We know what's best.
Well, and it seems with the Supreme Court that we've got, just that shift that we have at the moment, there doesn't seem like there's a lot of restrictions or holdbacks on anything that the government wants to do at the moment, in my view.
No. And well, and it's not like it's only a recent thing. After the Civil War, we had three amendments to the Constitution. You know, the first of them was the 13th Amendment that ended chattel slavery, except for in cases of incarceration, where they can force labor. And that's actually a form of slavery that is legal, continues to be legal in the United States. Also not mentioned in the Constitution, but argued in the courts, is the military draft is also a form of slavery that is not recognized or admitted to be such. But the 13th Amendment was won as a result of the Civil War. The 14th Amendment, which recognized that everyone born in the United States is a citizen of the United States, something that's being questioned by the regime right now, and that everyone, that not just citizens, but all people are recognized to have the equal rights under the 14th Amendment and due process of law. And the 15th Amendment that recognized the right of freed African-American males to vote. All of that's being pushed and rolled back these days. And that goes to the idea of the originalists, like the late Anthony Scalia on the Supreme Court and members of the present court who would call themselves originalists. What they're saying is we want to go back before the Civil War, where the people who have rights in the country are white males who own property. That's it. So a plutocracy is what they want, and a plutocracy, even before Donald Trump was elected, is what we've had for quite a while.
Yeah, certainly the history hasn't seemed, in my mind, to change much throughout all that time. And so it becomes rather desperate. How do you overcome this tide of history that's always been there?
Well, and you asked about the school, and one of the reasons for developing it was to prepare people to dig themselves out of that black hole of doubt and to take on the possibility of actually directing the lives of their own communities and making decisions for their communities as members of the community, as, by the way, also as members of their local ecosystem. We are biological beings, and we are members of the ecosystem in which we live, from which we draw our sustenance, the water, our food, all of it. We've sure scrambled it all up with whole geopolitical economy of, you know, let's send bananas from Central America and coconuts from the South Seas. And you know, you're going to have everything available in and out of season at your grocery store whenever you want it. There are luxuries that emperors and kings in the past never had. And we can say, well, we're living better than kings these days. But actually, the price is very high. The price on the survivability of future generations may be, we'll find out how prohibitive they are.
Yeah, it seems to be growing that way anyway. We have little things that come up, and certainly the environmental devastations of the last couple decades have been just phenomenal. The weather shifts and the fires and floods and all the rest that are just absolutely devastating. It's challenging.
It certainly is. And we live in a time that is revolutionary in a wrong way. We've revolutionized a good portion of humanity's relationship to the world around us. And that means the natural world, but it also means the rest of humanity and our relationship to the rest of humanity. When profit making stands ahead in line of community and responsibility to our fellow human beings, we're set on a suicide mission. We are headed down a road that is not going to turn out well for an awful lot of us, if not all of us, because the premises don't include survival. They only include momentary enjoyment of profit, of privilege, of luxury and leisure.
Yeah, what's prioritized? It brings me to the thought, too. I saw on the website that you guys have the idea of the ego versus a unitary vision of the world, and the ego being, I'm the one, it's all about me, and the unity being more of that, I guess, indigenous feeling of we're all a part of a very big thing, and we need each other, not just at the human level, but at the ego level as well.
It's true. And indigenous cultures around the world are worth listening to and paying attention to, because we can learn how human beings have for millennia survived well, done okay living in their natural communities, living as parts of those natural communities, as opposed to the Western so-called Enlightenment era definition of humans as living, we are actually separate and superior to that world. And when I say that world, not just the natural world, but the human beings living close in close proximity with the natural world. And so why would Enlightenment philosophers come up with arguments for humans, or at least modern at the time, what they thought of as modern humans being superior to and separate from the rest of existence on the planet? And what I come to, as I understand it, these folks that were writing these, in many ways, remarkable philosophical tracts, you know, was that their job? Did they get, you know, did they get paid for doing this? In fact, they did. They had patrons. They had wealthy patrons. And that's, you know, it's great to have a wealthy patron when you've got a project you want to work on, if you're an artist or whatever you are. But they also had strings attached. And what they wrote was also by way of propaganda. And what were they propagandizing? And the answer to that seems to be empire. European expansion across the globe. If you want to rationalize and make it sound reasonable that England or France or Spain or Portugal or whoever, Denmark, should be able to go anywhere in the world and take whatever they want to serve the homeland, resources, slaves, you name it. One way to justify it is to say, well, we're different. We're separate from all of that. We're superior to all of that. We're enlightened. Our intelligence, our gunpowder tells us that we're superior. Our ships, our technology, all of those things tell us we live differently in superior ways to the people out there who are subsistence living within the natural order. And that natural order, which, you know, if you're going to justify conquest, you need help. You need to go to the Pope, who's the spiritual leader of much of Europe at the time, and you need to get the doctrine of discovery, you know, and the Pope did. He proclaimed the doctrine of discovery. If European Christian nations go to the Americas or India or wherever they go, they can claim ownership of it. You know, the Pope actually divided up the Western Hemisphere, North and South America, between Spain and Portugal, drew a line down through the North and South America on the map, and said, to the east, that's Spain. To the west of this line is Portugal. That's how Brazil became Portuguese ownership. And Florida became Spain's and all of that. One man, one line on a piece of paper, and that line became a law that divided one hemisphere of planet Earth and turned it into property owned by two distinct monarchies, property. That's how you create legitimate ownership of things that aren't yours. The law of conquest, the doctrine of discovery, and the justifications are, well, they aren't Christian nations. They're not saved. What's there? They never wrote up a deed, so there's no law on their side to argue. We have the law on our side. We did write up a deed. Here it is. We need to know that those arbitrary legalizations of tyranny shouldn't stand historically. And just because they were done erroneously in the past doesn't mean that we should uphold the results today. But we do. The rule of property, you know, look in law dictionaries, the rule of property is about property ownership claims should not be challenged, even if their origins are erroneous.
Well, and I noticed, too, in the training section that you have, I kind of found this demarcation between the early side of human beings conforming to what they're taught and all of that, and just how limited we become in that conforming to what's there, to this definition of you can become more than that, and this idea of becoming. And in being a former teacher and instructor, kind of that curriculum came out very strong to me of, okay, this is where you were as a conformist, but this is where you need to be in figuring out how to become a better person and more in tune with the environment and with the world.
And recognizing, Max, that it's difficult for people to become nonconformist in order to accomplish that. Nonconformity is, there's an awful lot of peer pressure, social pressure. You know, your own family will tell you, no, you can't be that outlier. That's, you're just going to have a miserable life if you don't get yourself a nice job, work for the corporation, you know, all of the, you know, the usual things. And it's very difficult. It's very difficult for each individual to question what they've been taught. My parents, they love me. They wouldn't lie to me about things like America is a great democracy. They wouldn't lie to me and say that corporations are okay because that's how you make a livelihood. They'd never do anything to harm anybody because that would be bad PR. They would never manipulate the law so that they could go into a foreign country, take all of their natural resources, and then claim, well, it's in payment for a loan that the IMF gave to the dictator of that country, and the dictator spent the money on a palace instead of on education for his people. I mean, all of the nefarious ways that things come out, that's the side of life that is kept from our eyes as we go to school. When I was in school, if I had claimed that the United States of America is a global empire, I know that my history teacher would have corrected me and said, no, of course not. It's not an empire. We don't have colonies. Well, we have military based in 170 countries. I don't know. We might have colonies if you want, but we just don't call them that. I mean, language is a powerful thing. And whether it's by naming something what it isn't or the reverse, you know, it's pretending it isn't what it is. So that's why I think, by the way, that the idea of purpose of a system is what it does makes so much sense. Let's stop arguing about whether the intent was good. What does it do? And if what it does is evil, let's stop it doing that.
Well, it's interesting you bring up education as well. And I did want to address, I found Howard Zinn being prominently featured in terms of quotes and things for a lot of the education you had. And being in Indiana, my former governor, Mitch Daniels, actually took on the idea that Howard Zinn's books should not be taught in any public school in the state of Indiana. So you go to that systemic idea of a system is what it does. Public education, if you're taking out questioning of anything related to not being in that conformist idea, that's not education. You need to question everything.
Well, so we should probably call it what it is, not education, but indoctrination.
Yeah, there's so many of those things that you listed out, the incarceration system and all the rest. And we've had guests on here who have been incarcerated and talked about what that was like for them. There's just so many of those systems that you're absolutely right. It is what it does. It's not what we say it does.
Right, right. It's tough. And now people like Howard Zinn, it was great that he popularized the truth, which popularizing the truth is a tough sell. And yes, you're going to get lambasted, and the official world, the schools, the government, and the rest are going to condemn somebody who condemns the system. Don't make us look bad, because that's what we're promoting. We're teaching the kids this is good. You shouldn't tell us it's bad. But that's what we have to do. You know, Tom Paine wrote Common Sense back in 1776, in the very beginning of the year. By the end of the year, there was a call for a Declaration of Independence and a revolution against the British Empire. What he wrote inspired commoners to say, we'll leave the farm behind and go out and we're going to fight the most powerful empire on earth, because we think we'd like to have this world that Tom Paine's talking about, where we can be free, where we're not, you know, second class or third class citizens, if citizens at all. But what's interesting is, come to the McCarthy era, for instance, and during the McCarthy years, you know, 1950 to 54 or so, 55, the writings of Tom Paine were banned officially by the government. Even a biographical novel by Howard Fast called Citizen Paine was removed from the libraries in the schools. When we look at the White House website today and plans for a America 250 celebration of the Declaration of Independence, they start at the end of the year instead of the beginning of the year with Common Sense. Why don't they start with Common Sense? The same reason, I would say, that the books of Tom Paine and books about Tom Paine, biographies and so forth, were banned. One other little piece of information that most people don't know about, it's kind of absence, I guess. If it isn't there, you don't notice it isn't there. But there are a lot of monuments in Washington, D.C. to the Founding Fathers, what they call the Founding Fathers. What they really mean is the framers of the second U.S. Constitution, the one we have now. Actually, the one we have now is the third. It's the one with the Civil War amendments that they're trying to strip out. But the fact is that the first Constitution was the Articles of Confederation, and it did not create a country. It created an alliance of 13 separate countries, non-centralized. It's worth noting that. It's worth noting that Tom Paine does not have, back to the monuments and so forth, there is no monument to Tom Paine in Washington, D.C. It is an erasure. You know, remember when it was cancel culture was the big phrase going around, oh, we got to stop cancel culture. We've had cancel culture since 1776. Tom Paine is not memorialized officially. He's the guy who actually inspired commoners to fight the British and win for the 1%, who then took over and wrote a constitution for us all to obey that is based on commerce and property, not on rights, like Tom Paine suggested it should be. The real history of America 250, that's one of the educational programs that CELDEF is going to be pursuing this year. We are going to be putting out at least monthly a historical correction to the jingoistic version of 1776 that will see the drumbeat for that throughout the country throughout the year.
I very much look forward to following that. I think that will be informative, and I look forward to getting more information from CELDEF. We're on our end of time at the moment. I really wish I could keep on talking for a long time. This is fascinating to me. I was fascinated by what I read on your website, and we will certainly be encouraging people to go to the CELDEF website, get some of that education, and for communities maybe to seek out assistance from CELDEF. I assume that's something that you all do. And we certainly have here in Indiana reason to reach out to organizations that could be helpful like that.
Sure. Yes, we love talking to folks in their communities and offering what advice we can. We don't have a giant organization to just send an army out to help each community that asks, but we also have a different perspective. And I think that we can offer consultations and information that will be outside of the box, that will create outcomes that are quite different from what we are instructed to try to get. Let's stop asking for what's the best deal we can get from our oppressors, and let's start asking what it is we actually need and want for our communities. And happy to, folks can send a note to info@celdf.org, and we will get back to you.
That sounds very good. Thank you for being here today, Ben. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Max. Have a great new year.
You too.
Thanks for listening to Sacred Legions, hosted by Max Goler. Original music by Jamie Callan. To hear archived episodes, visit our website, www.sacredlegions.org, or check us out on your favorite podcast service. You will learn more about people behaving decently in indecent times and about the nonprofit organizations they support. Don't forget to check out our merchandise shop. Sacred Legions is a production of Sacred Legions, LLC.